This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 18th of January 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Zurich, not London, with me, Tyler Brûlé, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up in today's programme, as Switzerland now faces a national vote on mandatory conscription, we'll be asking whether there's a place for military service in the modern world.
And we'll also be talking to Dickon Bues, author of Swiss Watching. He'll be sharing some of his observations on Swiss life with us here in studio.
And we'll be atop of the city of Zurich with its first big skyscraper, the Prime Tower, with Andres Janser from the city's design museum.
It has just one color, which changes with the light and with the sun and also with the darkness or the brightness of the natural light. The presence is strong enough, but it has a certain discreteness, which you may call Swiss, if you want to.
Plus, we'll be joined in the studio by David Marquardt of Zurich-based Mach Architecture, and also our design editor, Hugo MacDonald, is fresh from the Cologne Furniture Fair to discuss how the landscape of the city is evolving, right here on Midori House, live from Zurich on Monocle 24. But before all of that, over to London for the news with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Iran said today it was in touch with big powers to hold fresh talks soon, but the European Union denied it, with Britain saying Tehran had yet to show willingness for negotiations on its disputed nuclear work without preconditions. Meanwhile, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov warned that an attack on Iran would cause a catastrophe and said US and European Union sanctions against Tehran were rather aimed at triggering popular discontent. Italian police have located the exact spot where the doomed Costa Concordia was pierced by sharp rocks that ripped open a hole in its hull, and believe that once the vast ship approached the outcrop, a disaster was almost certain. The spot, in about 8 metres of water, is just 10 metres away from a large rock outcrop jutting out of the sea, some 30 metres from the shore. The ship's captain, Francesco Scatino, is accused of bringing the Concordia dangerously close to the shore. Giglio's tourism manager, Elizabeth Nani, says boats often sail close to the island.
It's happened before because sometimes there's people on board that are from the island. So, you know, as a gesture, they sound the horn a few times, you flash the lights. It's quite a spectacle. And but usually they're a lot further away.
The former Madagascar leader Marc Ravalomanana will return to the Indian Ocean island imminently in a statement released by his South African publicist. Exiled in South Africa since rebel troops helped topple him in 2009, Ravalomanana has been sentenced in absentia to life in prison for the killings of demonstrators by elite troops in the run-up to his removal. Madagascar's interim leader has said the return of the exiled former president risked stoking tensions on the island, which has been plagued by instability for most of the past 3 years. Nomadic Tuareg rebels, backed by former soldiers from Libya, stepped up attacks on towns in northern Mali today, ending a fragile peace that had held between the separatists and the government since 2009. Up to 500 armed Tuaregs, who fought for ousted Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, sought refuge in Mali late last year as his rule crumbled, raising concerns that their presence would reignite uprisings in the Saharan desert. The English page of Wikipedia, the world's free online encyclopedia, was dark today, except for a paragraph urging users to protest legislation designed to stop copyright piracy, but the Wikipedia says could fatally damage the free and open internet. Supporters say the bill is needed to protect the film and music industry, but the Obama administration has also raised concerns, hinting it may use its veto to scupper the bills. Wiki's head of communications, Jay Walsh, says they want to see a public backlash against the Stop Online Piracy Act.
It is detrimental to the free and open web. It's detrimental to Wikipedia. And we want to make sure that we send a message potentially getting rid of this bill, potentially killing SOPA PIPA here in the United States, and creating a better dialogue around the right kinds of bills to support the free and open web.
And two high-profile independent Russian presidential candidates, billionaire Mikhail Porkorov and Yabloko Liberal Party founder Grigory Yavlinsky, submitted the required minimum 2 million signatures to the Russian Central Electoral Commission today, 2 hours before the deadline to register as presidential candidates. The presidential election will be held on March the 4th. The current Prime Minister, Vladimir Putin, is widely expected to win to return the office he held from 2000 to 2008. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Dankeschön, Herr Kelly, and now to Thomas Schaffernecker with the weather.
The weather, in association with Kiwoni Travel.
After a few days of cold, tranquil, sunny weather, Western countries in Europe are shrouded with cloud, rain is falling, and it's turned a little less cold as well. The second half of the week, lots of rain in Germany, snow in Central and Eastern Europe, as well as the Balkans and in the Alps. Once it starts snowing, it won't stop for 2 or 3 days. If you want fine weather, mild weather, the south of Spain or Portugal is the place to be. Here's Thursday's City Outlook. In London, 10 Celsius and rain. Amsterdam, 6 Celsius with rain too. In Oslo, 0, partly cloudy. In Lisbon, 15 degrees and sunshine. North America now. Winter weather continues to hit the Pacific Northwest of the United States. Downtown Seattle, more fresh snow through Wednesday and Thursday. The poor rainy weather has also affected northern parts of California, but San Francisco and LA is mostly sunny. Along the eastern seaboard of the US, after a couple of rainy days, good sunny and crisp weather is on its way. Here's Thursday's city forecast. Toronto, -6, partly cloudy. In New York City, 2 Celsius, also partly cloudy. In Chicago, -8 with snow flurries. And in Seattle, 0 degrees and snow. On to other world destinations for the next 48 hours. In the Middle East and Cairo, fairly cloudy here, highs of around 16 degrees. The night temperatures are a little on the chilly side, only 4 degrees in Cairo. In Abu Dhabi, sunny, pleasantly warm at 22. And the other side of Africa, in Casablanca, a modest 18, but sunny with a breeze off the desert. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernecker here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Thomas. You are listening to Midori House. We're in Zurich today, right here on Monocle 24. We're back in a moment.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 tagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei ole kosan.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propajalava.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House on Monocle 24. It's time for you to use your German, Andrew.
Which bit do you want me to use?
Which three words?
It's not three words. I've got more than that.
Now, Zurich was nice to you today. It was very nice to you yesterday, but they've Thomas Schaffernecker laid on some very nice weather for us.
Extraordinary weather. It's been big blue skies all day. And, so great for getting around. Yeah, Zurich has looked great today. So.
Now, you're going to be doing a bit of extra work here as well. Do you want to plug your program for everyone? What show do you do in case people don't know?
I do The Urbanist, which previews every Thursday. And actually, I'm doing a couple of stories here that will be used over the next couple of weeks. We're going to be doing...
Tram spotting. It's going to be a whole series.
I'm riding the trams tomorrow with the with the head of the trams to talk about why trams are a good thing.
Mm.
And one of our guests coming on now is going to do another little thing for me afterwards.
Right.
And I've got another story, but I'm not going to tell you about it.
Well, it's interesting because I think when we remarked all day, I think when you travel around Zurich and of course you were looking at all of the very handsome trams. I want you to ask tomorrow when you go and ride the trams about the sort of the new smiling tram, about, you know, how much sort of Zurich thought about actually really sort of the front of that vehicle, because it looks very happy, looks very jolly.
Yes, it's got a good grin on it, the tram, hasn't it?
I think it's also designed in a way that also it wouldn't hurt so much if it ran you down either.
Yeah, it doesn't look.
It looks gentle.
Yeah, it doesn't look as though it could run you down actually, because it's kind of glides along, and it's just like, it looks like it might nudge you out the way if you were by mistake standing on the rails.
Is it the last time we anchored out of Switzerland? That was I think I was up in Graubünden. I was up in Samaritz, and we were talking at that time about the whole notion of conscription, and it's certainly a theme which it's been a cover story in the magazine. And I think at that point we're talking about also the end of conscription in Germany. And we had, well, you had in studio in London one of the defense attachés from the Finnish military, and it was interesting to talk to them. Just about, you know, how important conscription is to really almost the national character of Finland, and how it really wasn't so much of a debate. In fact, that it comes up from time to time, but you know, the notion of conscription is not really such a big topic.
No, I think what's interesting is the countries that have held on to conscription, especially Finland. You know, there's a country that's actually only 100 years old. It's had, I think, 5 wars in 100 years, and it really feels that it survived because it had a conscripted army, and that everyone was able to go to their wardrobe and find the hidden gun at the moment of, you know, when they had to kind of go into battle. But it's interesting. I don't know. We have a Marcus Hippie is one of our producers back in London who's Finnish. And I was asking him about his view.
Did he do national service?
He did national service. He said he watched a lot of Dallas.
Right.
Because he was in a very remote place and they just didn't have that much for him to do. So he was kind of stuck up watching TV most of the time.
He wasn't stuck up while watching TV.
but oddly, he did like it. Mm. He enjoyed it.
No, because certainly it's a hot topic here. It rears its head from time to time. What's interesting in this country, Switzerland without an army, which is a political organization, they just recently submitted 107,000 signatures, which is, of course, enough to prompt a national referendum on the issue. Parliament, I guess, is returning soon. And on that note, we've invited in Bruno Letzi, who's a lecturer of political science at the University of Zurich, but also for 25 years was also the Neue Zürcher Zeitung's editor for security and military policy. Welcome, Mr. Letzi.
Good evening.
I wanted to start on this topic. It's obviously something Switzerland without an army, they've been around for some time. This is not something which has just reared its head in the last 2 years. You were saying before we went on air, they've been around for about 30 years now. So how often has this topic actually come up as a serious discussion?
I think every 10 years we have to discuss about the armed forces in Switzerland. 1989 we had to vote against the initiative of this group for a Switzerland without armed forces. People decided for the Swiss armed forces, and now we have to vote about against conscription in Switzerland.
Mm. I mean, every year, or let's say started 1989, has there always, have we seen an increase in people actually voting against conscription?
Not for the moment. I can't say that. It's difficult, this question, because the identity of Switzerland is very connected with conscription, with the militia system of the armed forces.
Mm. I mean, if you felt at the moment, when you talk to contemporaries, when you talk to younger people in Switzerland, what is the mood like here? Because I guess when you see your neighbor like Germany gets rid of it, and people see that, I mean, you're really one of the few countries left. Of course, we're talking about Finland at the beginning. So I'm wondering, where does the national mood sit, do you think?
Oh, as you know, we have this annual strategic surveys, and then you can follow the trends. Mm. And in Switzerland now, about 48% of the population are for conscription, and about 43% for a professional army. Mm. But if you ask them, or if you give them other alternatives, then they are for conscription, and not for a volunteer militia or to draft foreigners for the armed forces. They are for conscription now.
I wanted to know, do you think that Swiss people see a role in conscription in binding the country together? You know, what's fascinating is when you look at, as an outsider, here's a country where you speak four languages, you're a very diverse group of people, yet you hold together around certain things, certain values. And I wondered whether throwing everyone together at a young age, forcing them to do conscription, was a way of kind of making sure that, you know, the country didn't kind of pull apart into its separate cantons and into separate identities.
That is right. But society and the work world changed a lot, and it's a different world. I see that my son, for example, he studied law at the University of Zurich. Now he's writing a thesis. And at the same time, in the militia, he is examining a magistrate, and he has to work every week, one day for the armed forces, and it's too much. If you have a civil career, a civil job, then it's very difficult to combine the military service with a civil career.
And do you think that's also just, as you said, the modern world? Because, yeah, I mean, you know, more electronic devices, you know, more things that make our job supposedly easier, just actually compounds the workload. So maybe, I guess, for people who aren't familiar with it, I mean, the Swiss workplace is supposed to be considerate of your time that you spend in the military. But I would imagine a lot of modern managers maybe are not so sympathetic.
It Of course, that's a problem. When I was a young general staff officer 20 years ago or more, then I had in every bank of Switzerland, Credit Suisse or Union Bank of Switzerland, I had a general director, who made military service with me, general staff officers. The general directors were almost general staff colonels. Then that changed. Now you have international people as managers from England, from the United States, from the Netherlands, and they have difficulties to understand this Swiss militia system.
Mm. I mean, Andrew, it's interesting. It's, you know, people always talk in the UK about the old boys network, and of course, you know how that is, you know, so not just linked to public schools, but also I think for people who have spent time in the British military, it's interesting to see that that's almost a concept which exists here. I remember when we were doing our work with Swiss, people talked about a helicopter mafia at the airline, because you had a lot of very senior people who were at the top of the airline who had all served as basically chopper pilots. And do you see these, Mr. Letzi, do you see these types of clans all over Swiss business society still?
These clans, these networks, these connections, these general staff connections, helicopter connections, they disappear. They disappear. Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. What are the, let's say, the hot topics? I mean, clearly, if there's 107,000 signatures right now, are people just looking at the cost at the moment? Is it purely budget, or what drives this?
The budget is very important for the moment. We had a big discussion last autumn in the parliament about the reform of the organization of the Swiss Armed Forces. We will reduce the armed forces from about 200,000 soldiers to 100,000 soldiers. We have to buy new fighter jets. We decided, or the government decided, for the Gripen, for 22 fighter jets, we have to... they cost about 3 billion Swiss francs. And that are the budget is really important for all the issues of the Swiss Armed Forces. And for the moment, not the conscription question.
Mm. Can I just ask you the question about Switzerland's preparedness for an attack? You know, it seems to be based almost on the idea of something like a Second World War attack, you know, people coming across the border. And you know, we were told last night about...
That's why the Swiss franc is high, to keep the Germans out.
Okay, right. We were told last night by someone we were talking to that it was a bit of a myth, because, you know, although people still had the guns in their houses, they weren't allowed to keep the ammunition in their houses anymore. So is it really part, almost a... It really doesn't make any sense anymore.
not for the moment, I would say. No, that is a difficulty of Switzerland, you know. Neutrality is deeply rooted in the Swiss population. We participate, of course, in the KFOR mission in Kosovo. We are in Bosnia, but the government, or not the Minister of Defense, is against the engagement in foreign countries, engagement in multinational operations. And that is a difficulty for Switzerland. Sweden has changed, of course. Sweden has changed the organization of the armed forces. They participate in Afghanistan, but Switzerland is really a problem for Switzerland. To have a modern concept of defense.
One quick point, again, this is the same person we were speaking to last night, said that he wasn't taken to the army because he had an allergy to house dust. And we wondered, you know, was it actually in the interests of people testing people for military service, it was like, we just cannot take all these people, that they were finding excuses actually to get rid of people from joining the service. Is that a fair view?
I think it's still the fairness of the draft is still exists.
Okay.
Yeah.
And just finally, I have one more question as well. You know, is part of the mission of the Swiss military, you know, at a time when, okay, no one's going to come across the border, but yet, you know, who knows how unsecure Europe could become. I mean, would you say part of one of the main missions today is to be able to just secure the borders and close the country if they needed to?
Yeah, but for the moment, the main mission is to support the civil authorities in crisis situation. Because, you know, Switzerland has not police forces, as, for example, Italy with the Carabinieri, or France with Gendarmerie Mobile. And we need to sustain in crisis situations, we need the armed forces to support the police forces. And therefore, we have more soldiers than other countries.
Great. Bruno Letzi, thank you very much. You're listening to Midori House. We're in Zurich today. We're back in a moment.
The February issue of Monocle has a warm glow as we look at how charm adds longevity to brands, makes offices great places to work, and keeps people returning to the same restaurants year after year. But there's more.
In the culture section, our man in Tokyo, Kenji Hall, wandered around the corner to Daikanyama's hottest new retail experience, Tsutaya. I jumped on the Eurostar to visit Air, making their new album, La Voyage dans la Lune, and there's four cracking album reviews, more of which you can hear on Monocle 24.
Plus, there's our Japan travel survey, a visit to a jail-turned-craft school in Charleston, a neighbourhood to call home in Stockholm, and a rugged tale from Tehran. The February issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Every week, Monocle editor Andrew Tuck looks at cities around the world and the people, buildings and open spaces that make up the urban landscape. With interviews and discussions of the spaces and places we live in, The Urbanist is your very own urban audio retreat. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24, and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and, of course, on iTunes.
And you're back with Midori House with Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. It's just coming up to 21 minutes past 1900 here in Zurich at Tone Studio Z. That's where we are. People might think that there are our own Swish studios that we've built, but they're not. We had to rent today.
Swiss and Swish.
Yeah, well, they're both, aren't they?
Yeah,
I'm both. Actually, I want to have some acoustic stripes now. I think we might have to redo our studios in London. Now, Andrew, if you were going to be part, just in the segment before, if you were going to be part of, let's say, a Swiss sort of military mafia, I mean, would you have been in sort of, you know, the chopper brigade? Or where would you have fit in? Or would you have been running the military weekly rag?
I've got a horrible feeling I might have been in the kitchens or something. Mm. I'm not sure that I'd have been let anywhere near a gun.
It was interesting.
A staple gun, maybe.
Listening to Mr. Letzi when he was talking about the fact that there's no sort of national police force, in this country. And, I think we've both maintained before, in a country like Switzerland, you have 7.5 million people, roughly, who all feel like they're the police. And I would love to know what our next guest, as we mentioned in the intro, Dickon Buse is here, and he has written a book called Swiss Watching, which is, an Englishman's observation up close of the people who not just run this country, but also populate the place. And I'm wondering, is it sort of a bit of a... voluntary or involuntary police state as well?
I think you could say that. I think for expats living here, they find some of the systems of control quite confusing. There are very few CCTV cameras here, unlike in England, for instance, where they're on every street corner. But Neighbourhood Watch is very effective here, so that if you happen to wash your car on a Sunday, or if you did what I did when I first arrived and went to the bottle bank on a Sunday, which is forbidden, and as I was putting my glass bottles in the bottle bank... And
someone came up and smacked you.
Well, a little old lady appeared and told me off and pointed to the sign, which I had totally failed to see, saying, "No recycling, even on God's holy day, you can't save the planet." So I think some of those rules confuse foreigners a bit when they first move here. And especially the things that you can and can't do on Sunday. You can't go shopping, you can't do any DIY. In some buildings, you can't do your laundry because of the noise.
Mm.
And so I think it does feel a bit controlled in some ways, but then there are lots of freedoms in the fact that you can walk around and not be on private or closed-circuit television all the time.
Right. I mean, it's fascinating because Andrew's heard the story, a few times, but I was, when I was living in London and before I moved to Zurich for a while, and I spent about a year and a half here, we can come back to also the regional differences as well, but, you heard all of these kind of crazy stories sometimes that that people would talk about, having a shower late at night and how they'd get told off and everything, and, I remember, I lived in, of course, one of these, you know, you're also in Switzerland. It's not like the UK or America. I mean, homes are built out of, you know, concrete and stone and they're solid. And yet I felt that my neighbors must have had their ears up to the ceiling because they said, you know, please don't wear leather-soled shoes when you go to the airport to catch this flight. I think they actually tried, they went and did the back math and said, oh, he must be taking that flight to London if he's up at this time. And there was always just sort of a steady stream of notes under my door. It was, and yeah, these things do happen here.
But part of that is they expect you to respect their privacy because they will do the same to you.
Yeah.
They will respect your privacy to an extreme that you can live in the same building with someone and you'll pass pleasantries. It'll literally just be hello in the staircase for 15 years before you get further than that. And getting onto first name terms can sometimes take forever.
Mm.
And does that have a kind of impact on what Swiss people are good and bad at doing? That kind of idea of being conformist. I wonder if that, you know, does that restrict, you know, if you're a, you know, if you came to London and you were, you know, a graphic designer or you were in music, you know, you'd want some space to kind of, you know, let your hair down, as it were, to not have to behave correctly all of the time. What happens if you get drunk on a Saturday night? You can't take your bottles out the next. You know, I wonder how much it restricts the rest of your life.
I think you just, when you grow up with it, you don't think of it as a restriction. You just think of it as part of society. I think when you come in as an outsider, that's when you notice the difference. Or when a Swiss person goes abroad and suddenly in America is confronted with waitresses introducing themselves with their first name just to take their order, they find that very intrusive in their private space.
Even English people don't like that.
Well, yes. I find it, I was in America last summer and I found it very strange that hi, I'm Chelsea and I'm going to take your order. And it's like, why do I need to know your first name? Let alone the state where you come from, which is written on your badge. But the interesting thing about Switzerland is that it is quite conformist, but within that conformity or that pressure to conform, there's amazing innovation. And the Swiss have invented loads of interesting things which most people probably don't know are Swiss, like the electric toothbrush or the toilet duck or tinfoil or LSD, really useful things. And they just don't shout about them being Swiss because generally they're very modest, and even in a workplace, you don't push yourself forward, you don't blow your own trumpet. So all these things which were invented here, probably no one knows they're Swiss. Not even many Swiss people probably don't know they're Swiss. So
Andrew likes to squeeze his toilet duck in the office.
There was another element of the book which I was reading before we came, which I found fascinating, is this idea that this is a society that despite being very wealthy, the majority of people don't own their property. You know, they rent. And the impact that has, again, on people, you know, I think you were saying that, you know, to simple things, you don't see estate agents, you don't have negative equity, you don't have signs for sale all over the place. How much part of Swiss, you know, Swissness is, does that add to as well?
I think it's quite important. I mean, you must remember that in Germany and France and Italy, a lot of people rent as well. It's a particularly Anglo-Saxon thing to have this obsession with buying your property. And in Bern, for instance, only 10% of people own their own flat. It's very low. And the national average is about 35% own their own flat. And what it does, it takes away that pressure to always move forward. And so it has that feeling that you are part of society and maybe your building is owned by a cooperative. And so you have to get on with your neighbours. You may not interact with them personally, but you have to get on with them because you will, even though you rent your flat, you probably stay in that flat your whole life or 20, 30 years. And so again, it's that slight pressure to conform, but without that pressure to always succeed and move up the property ladder.
I mean, I would venture that the fact that you live in Bern, also that you're running an English language bookstore there, a Stauffacher English bookshop, you know, might suggest the fact that you rather like the place. And I'm wondering, you know, when you go and meet Chelsea and she's serving you chicken wings in the States, etc. I mean, do you come back to Switzerland and just think, actually, maybe the world needs a little bit more Switzerland, not just on their wrists or not in the form of more Nespresso capsules, but, you know, but even maybe the way the sort of the construct of daily life works?
I mean, I say in the book, if there were more places like Switzerland, the world would be a better place. But at the same time, the Swiss, in the book, I liken them to coconuts, in that, not that they're small, brown and hairy, although I'm sure some are.
I think there's plenty of those.
It's just they're quite hard to get to know and to get through that outer shell, whereas English-speaking people, especially Americans, are more like peaches, quite soft on the outside. You meet someone at a party and your friends on Facebook by the end of the evening. That almost never happens here.
Mm.
The trouble with being a peach in the land of coconuts is you get bruised quite easily. And so when I come back here, yes, I do like lots of things about living here, but some of the things that are quite hard is the lack of interaction, the lack of public humour, the lack of not being able to make an orderly queue, those sort of things which I miss.
I don't want to make things too serious, but you know, obviously you've come from the UK, but does it make it very difficult for people who come to Switzerland, you know, if they're from Morocco or if they're from Turkey, and these rules just seem so alien and so complicated? Does that make it, is that one of the many reasons that, you know, that maybe Swiss people do find it in some quarters quite difficult to accept people who are not Swiss?
I think that's true. And you have to remember, the Swiss had no empire. They have no history of colonialism or of integration. Non-white, non-Christian immigration is a very new thing here. Even the immigrants in the 60s were from Italy and Portugal and were all Catholics and white. And so the teething pains that we have at the moment with referendums to ban new minarets and the anti-immigration posters that you see from the right-wing party is kind of what Britain went through in the 40s and 50s. And Switzerland, as in many things, is about 50 years behind the rest of the world.
On that note, I'm wondering, when you said, like, you know, if you're out at a party and then you're not sort of, you know, friends with someone on Facebook by the end of the evening, is there also just a generally slower uptake because, you know, just with trends and other things? Because, you know, there's times when I think, God, you know, Switzerland, you know, you've got Italy next door, but then you can sort of go two valleys beyond and it's like, do these people not get magazines in this valley? Do hair trends like not penetrate? Why is there so much facial hair? You know, going back to your coconut analogy, I'm wondering.
And mullets—they're still quite popular.
Mullets are very, very popular here, even in the police force. Is that part of also being an island nation in many ways?
I think it is. I think it's part of the fact that up until the train system arrived, people didn't venture beyond their valley very much. And I have friends who live in Bern who have never been to St. Gallen, which is only 2 hours away. It's the other side of Switzerland. They speak a strange dialect over there. I'm not going to understand them. I almost need my passport to go past Zurich. And it is that kind of local mentality, local things for local people.
Dick and Hughes, we're going to have to leave it there. The book is called Swiss Watching. It's out when? Is it?
It's out in English now, all over the place.
Okay, good.
And so in German in March.
Oh, that will be interesting to see how that goes down. We look forward to it. Anyway, Dick and Hughes, the book Swiss Watching, Inside Europe's Landlocked Island. We're going to cross over to London now. I believe, Mr. Kelly, I hope you're there. I haven't seen you forever. I don't know what you look like anymore. I hope you don't have a mullet, Mr. Kelly. What's happening news-wise?
Certainly not. Here's the news from London. Iran said today it was in touch with big powers to hold fresh talks soon, but the European Union denied it, with Britain saying Tehran had yet to show willingness for negotiations on its disputed nuclear work without preconditions. Italian police have located the exact spot where the doomed Costa Concordia was pierced by sharp rocks that ripped open a hole in its hull, and believe that once the vast ship approached the outcrop, a disaster was almost certain. The former Madagascan leader Marc Ravalomanan will return to the Indian Ocean island imminently, according to a statement released by his South African publicist. The Syrian government has released another 187 prisoners arrested during the country's 10-month-old unrest under a general amnesty granted by President Bashar al-Assad. Nomadic Tuareg rebels backed by former soldiers from Libya stepped up attacks on towns in northern Mali today, ending a fragile peace that had held between the separatists and the government since 2009. The English page of Wikipedia, the world's free online encyclopedia, was dark today, except for a paragraph urging users to protest legislation designed to stop copyright piracy, but that Wikipedia says could fatally damage the free and open internet. The Burmese pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi officially registered her candidacy for the April by-election today. Two high-profile independent Russian presidential candidates submitted the required minimum 2 million signatures to the Russian Central Electoral Commission today to register as presidential candidates. And some financial news. European shares steady today in thin volume as investors were reluctant to take big bets after Greek debt restructuring talks needed to stave off a disorderly default resumed. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Nick. And actually, I think you might look quite nice with a mullet. But, well, we're not joined now.
We'd have to get him special headphones, though, wouldn't we?
You'd have to just clip on at the side and not go over the top of your head. But we're now joined in the studio by our own Hugo MacDonald, who's hot-footed it down from Cologne, where you've been at the Furniture Fair.
Is it down? Yes, it is down.
It is down.
Sorry, I shouldn't question your geography because mine's awful. I am. I'm fresh off the plane.
Okay, quick headline. We had poor Take do the Gucci show in, I think, 25 seconds earlier in the week. So do Cologne in 15. How was it?
Okay, lots of round edges, no more corners. Lots of Italians.
You say round edges, more organic in shape?
More organic in shape. Lots of very comfortable-looking sofas. And Italians, by the dozen, they've all come back to Germany. and a lot of reissues as well. Sort of, I mean, it's not a big surprise.
And you had a theory why everyone was in Germany.
Well, I did. It's quite a basic theory. Okay, well, just because everybody talks about German economy being so strong and the German consumer spending so much more than anybody else in Europe. There was a huge number of first-time showers and all the Italians slightly with their tails between their legs saying, well, no, we never gave up on Cologne. Actually, I haven't seen them there for the past 5 years.
Exactly. What about the Chinese?
No, the Chinese actually weren't there. It's quite interesting. I think the Chinese probably a little bit behind still think that Salone is the one to go for the money.
Right. And for copying.
Yeah, that too.
Should we have a song?
If you want.
Well, we're going to have a song because it's Swiss.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's good. That sounds good.
This is Yellow with, just like Hugo, The Expat. And that was The Expat from the Kings of Swiss Electronica, it says here. Dieter Meier and Boris Blank. And you know something about this song.
Well, I don't really know about the song, but earlier
I thought
today,
you'd guest starred on it or something.
No.
Back in the day.
I was doing something really bassy in the back. No, we drove by, do you recall? We drove by Dieter Meier's wife's pasta shop today.
That's right.
How's that for a connection?
How on earth do you know that?
Well, listen, if you spend any time with Hans Otto, who is our advertising rep in Switzerland, you know, you've met everybody, you know everyone's backstory, and you know, you also know what they're paying in rent every month. He knows everything as you drive around. And he says that we were going by this very, very cute little pasta shop on a corner, and he said, that's Mr. Meyer's wife's joint.
And apparently all the best Italian restaurants go there to buy their pasta.
Really?
Some of them might get
freshly
it delivered.
Made every day. Even.
I don't know about that. I don't want to make any sort of false claims.
We've got some dry fusilli for you later.
Yum.
Anyway, you're listening to the Midori House live from Zurich on Monocle 24.
And you are back in, I don't even know if it's Studio 1 or Studio 2. I like saying that we're in Studio 1 in London, but I think they might have two or three studios. I didn't see how many doors there were here. Feels like Studio 1, right? What?
Or Studio 2.
Studio 2.
Or Studio 5.
Okay, enough now. This could definitely deteriorate. Now, did you notice that there's a, when you were coming in from the airport, did you arrive early or late? I forget. Your flight was late yesterday, wasn't it?
I was on the only flight ever from Swissair to arrive late anywhere.
It's actually not called Swissair, in fact. It's called Swiss.
Swiss,
if you
recall, sorry.
We did the branding on that project. Anyway.
But I thought they'd rebranded it again. I thought they'd put the air back.
No, but we've been covering, of course, the whole development of the Zurich West district, and you might have noticed, because it's probably going to be something that'll somehow make it into your program, Andrew, the Prime Tower, which was designed by Gigon and Geyer, Annette Gigon and Mike Geyer of the architecture firm. It's 413 feet.
That's not very friendly to our metric people, is it?
No, it's not, actually.
That's a bit English.
But three, no.
Can you convert that?
Wait, no, I'm trying to. 125 meters, something like that?
I think it's a bit more.
You think it's more than that? I've got an architect. I'm getting a bit of a nod. Oh, look, I'm getting a nod through the glass. See, there you go.
You or me.
Anyway, tall building called the Prime Tower. And yeah, do you want to tell us more about it? No, you don't.
No, not really.
Okay. Anyway, we sent our Joe Furness out to find out more.
I'm on my way to the top of this landmark building, Prime Tower, Zurich's first skyscraper. The building is 124 metres, 36 stories high. That makes it the tallest in Switzerland. But in global terms, it's quite diminutive. The world's tallest building in Dubai is six times bigger than this. The new Shard in London will be more than double the size. Apparently, even the ancient Great Pyramid in Giza is bigger than this by about 20 metres. But in the context of the low-rise landscape of Zurich, this building is a colossus. So I've come up to the Clouds Bar to meet Dr. Andres Janser from the Design Museum in Zurich to talk about the architectural merit of the building.
It was intended from the beginning as the highest building within this area here in the western part of Zurich. And then the architects Gigon and Geyer here from Zurich chose a design which I would say quite close to art in terms of the idea of kind of a sculptural presence within the city, that the thinnest part is at the bottom, you know, at the ground, and then it gets kind of bigger in several steps if you look at it up to the top. So this makes it into a very interesting kind of object to look at. That impression is even enforced by the fact that I think every second element of that overall curtain glass facade can be moved outwards by between 20 or 30 centimeters. So you can do this, of course, more in summer than in winter, because then the air comes in, also kind of the noise from outside comes in, and you have kind of a combination of artificial natural ventilation of the office spaces. This is kind of a technical aspect, but it also changes the appearance. So it's a very interesting cultural event within the city of Zurich.
And what's your personal response to it? How do you feel about the building here in your city?
What I like about it is that on one hand, it has a quite different shape and appearance. It depends on from which side you look at it, from the east, from the south. If you look at it from the mountains which surround Zurich, it has very different shapes. And on the other hand, it has a certain, well, maybe not neutrality, but it has just one color, which changes with the light and with the sun and also with the darkness or the brightness of the natural light. The presence is strong enough, but it has a certain discreteness, which you may call Swiss, if you want to. But I think it has to do with something, it has very specific qualities which have to do a lot to do with Zurich and with the fact that they're designed by Swiss architects.
How do you think it fits into the landscape of Zurich, which of course is very, generally speaking, very low rise?
Zurich, in a way, always was, and I guess always will remain, what you call in English a garden city. But then if you think of high-rise buildings, the notion of the skyline is very important. And I always like to say that the Zurich skyline are the mountains just close by, like Uetliberg or what we call Zürichberg, but also the Alps, you know, which you can see from many places in the distance behind the lake. So the Zurich skyline always will be the mountains, and they haven't been changed by this high-rise building with its 124 meters. So even if you look at Uetliberg, which is 400 meters above the lake level, so it's still quite higher than this building.
And of course it stands a little bit away from the Altstadt, a little bit away from the sort of medieval centre of Zurich, where you find, you know, the Grossmünster and the Opera House and these historic buildings.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, and that's part of that urban plan. So it's maybe not the first, but one of the first really high buildings. And the urban plan explicitly says that you're not allowed to build high-rise buildings in the medieval part, near the lake, on the mountains. So this is one of these two exceptions. And I think that the planners have been very right to do that.
Talking about the exhibition that you curated at the end of last year, you looked at a great deal of high-rise buildings around the world. How does this building stand up, if you'll excuse the pun? Is it interesting in a global sense?
I would say so. But also, I mean, that one of the ideas of the exhibition was that you have to look at individual cities. And this, I would say, is a specific solution for a specific situation, which is a Zurich one, which is a Swiss one, which is around 2010 one. So it doesn't really make sense to try to compare it to, for instance, Burj Khalifa in Dubai, because the situation there is different, problems are different, also in terms of climate. Yes, it does stand out as a specific solution to a specific situation. Yes.
What do you think this building says about the future of Zurich?
I mean, we are here in this kind of western part of Zurich. We will see at least three or four more high-rise buildings coming up. Construction has already started or will start in the months to come. But as in many cases of high-rise buildings, especially of exceptional high-rise buildings like this one, it's also a symbol of optimism. And we're optimistic about things to come. I think so, and in a way also I hope so, that this optimism will remain.
So we're hearing clouds in the cafe bar at the top of Prime Tower, and it's absolutely packed today. People are obviously enjoying the sunny view. Does this building mean something to Swiss people?
Absolutely. It has been very well accepted by the people already. I mean, it was opened some, I think, 2 months ago, so it's quite new. And we will see if then Basel will actually come up with an even higher building. There's already a plan.
There's a competition now, is
there? Well, you may call it a competition. It will be an office building for one of his chemical building companies, designed by Herzog & de Meuron. So it could be interesting, and it would be higher than the Zurich one, but then again, who cares?
And that was Andres Janser from Zurich's Design Museum talking to Joan Furness about the Prime Tower. We're now joined in studio. Hugo is still stuck around. And also David Marquardt, firm friend of the family, architect extraordinaire. He designs a nice kitchen, I've been told. and even sampled as well. David, welcome.
Thank you. Good evening.
I wanted to start by, I mean, the extraordinary sort of pace of development that's happening, because, you know, you used to come into town and you would approach the Zurich West district. And yeah, I mean, there was, of course, you know, a lot of sort of disused railway lands and a lot of disused factories, etc. And now, you know, we have sort of the viaduct development. They've really started to try to sort of pull together or pull through a proper urban thread. And just beforehand, I was just asking you about a district where there used to be the old Hurlimann brewery in the city, which is, it's amazing. That was also a little bit disconnected, but they've really, you know, managed to develop this, you know, in a way that it really feels part of the city's fabric. And I guess what I'm wondering is, you know, when you look at a Swiss context, is that driven by good architecture and also because there's a great understanding of design, you know, on the part of the developers? Or is it really a city initiative and it's because you've got the right people in government here?
I think you have a big pressure of space need. You need some more space. And there was a long discussion, like, where can we build? And suddenly something happened. So I think Google, for example, went there because there was the space and you can actually assemble the amount of people you want into an office building right there. And I think it's a mix between this and then obviously good architecture. Mm. But I think good architecture is required when you build something really far away, like the bath of Zumthor. Who would go there if there wasn't a bath? So I think in Zurich, you're anyway. So good architecture is kind of needed because you have other architects who watch it.
Mm, but Andrew lives in Bloomsbury and Zurich's far away from him, and you were commenting on how much you like the flats when you went by today. And there was something striking about just the quality of housing that you saw for a brand new development, no?
Yeah, it looked great. It just looked, you know, there was a kind of use of light and material that was just, you know, immediately kind of, you know, pulled you in.
Yeah, I think that's a general thing, that our houses here have to be very insulated and very, very good built and well built. So that's something I think that happens anyway. And if you compare this quality that we require to do, then I think it makes it beautiful.
David, I just wanted to ask on the topic of housing, and we hear that Zurich is growing quite rapidly in terms of people moving here and businesses expanding rapidly, but housing is something that is still incredibly expensive. And because of the nature of Zurich and the geography around it, there's only really so much new housing that can be built. That, how will that sort of play out in the next 10 years?
We heard it before, you have a lot of flats that people live in since 20 years. So these rents, they won't go up. So actually they can stay in the city. But obviously when these houses are renovated and when you have to go one step, when you have to move, then you find houses that are developed just in the next area, like Oerlikon here. You have big developments that go on in the outer ring, and the center obviously is very, very expensive. It's getting really, really expensive. Also the lake, Küsnacht, and this area where the banks actually like the really, really rich people or the Russians buy their villas. I think that's really the middle class has to leave there, and This changed a little bit now, but it's still quite.
But is it a city where young people can stay, or do you feel that some people study here and then they have to move abroad because they're, or to a different city in Switzerland because they're sort of priced out of it?
I mean, I still see very many young people here. Some of them actually are rich, so that's not the question. But there is a whole scene of young creative people, and they are creative, so they find a way to live together or to organize themselves to rent also an old apartment and renovate it. I think that's still available, just not in the centre.
Mm. I just wanted to pick up on the conversation we had with Dickon. You know, do you find, as an architect, when you're in a city that's, you know, very controlling, very kind of strict about what can be built, what can't be built, do you find it sometimes difficult doing projects within the city that kind of match up to your creativity?
I mean, the rules you find everywhere. In an old town, you have very strict rules, and I think that these rules, if you follow them, that's not probably the problem. To do so, that's a normal task that you have to deal with as an architect.
I want to go back to that notion of problem, though. When you look around the urban environment of Zurich, and maybe we can expand the discussion to even other Swiss cities, but I mean, let's keep it here for a moment. I mean, what frustrates you when you look at the city right now? I mean, I know you're a keen driver, and there's, you know, and I guess, Andrew, you'd be covering this a little bit as well, but, you know, they really want to get cars off the road in the city, and you feel that they throw up lots of obstacles. But that aside, I mean, what else would you say? You look at this place as an architect thinking, God, I would love to do this. Or if I was an urban planner, I'd like to fix this.
I think the city boundaries are where the political boundaries are. But actually, the greater area of Zurich, you have all these little villages and the little areas with their own rules. That's what we hear before. So Switzerland is like divided in small portions. And there must be plans, and there are plans actually, to work on like... There is a bigger area of Zurich, a bigger area of Basel, and a bigger area of Geneva, and I just think the boundaries or the limits is these political or these political borders.
But what about from the built environment when you look at the state of new architecture? And I'm sure you would like to have more David Marquardt towers. You know, you'd like to see the Mark architecture name on maybe more developments, but not just that. You know, when you look at housing or retail, etc., you know, are you proud of what you see around the city, or do you think there's room for improvement?
No, I think that's it's a question of the scale. I think I always said Zurich is too small to be a big city and too big to be a little village. So it was always this nice scale in between, and the developments that are going on right now with the tower, with the Tony Moltke Rai, which is a very, very big development for art, and actually the young people who then...
When we were young people, we used to dance there, didn't we?
yes, that's true. That's a long time ago. Mm. It's demolished already, actually. I think that this what I really see is this clash between this very nice, small and cute scale of the old town, and on the other side you have these big buildings. I think this needs some time to grow together. But the quality from both, I think it's given, because we have a good city watchers. Like, we have a good department for architecture here.
And David, just to bring it back to you and your work, it's quite a rare breed in that you do the majority of your work outside of Switzerland. Whereas, from my experience, Swiss architects tend to work predominantly in Switzerland, and it's quite a sort of insular industry. Do you notice working with people sort of internationally that the made in Switzerland quality applies to architecture as well?
I think it's a repetition of Swiss quality. I don't really know where it comes from, probably from history. But when I met some clients, for example, a Russian guy, he told me, "Oh, you're Swiss, you're in time, you're precise." And that's just, I didn't even show up the first time. So it's like, but he still was convinced that this is the quality. And I think it's an advantage. You can export, and we really deliver in time, and we deliver good quality. I think that's something we can be proud of, but obviously other countries are doing the same thing.
Does it strike you, that element of quality, when you go to other cities around the world? You know, it's a very basic thing, but we often, Tyler has talked about this, you know, that at least in Switzerland, when you shut the window, you don't get a draft, or when you shut a door, it clicks shut and it's solid. And it's, do you think there's just a higher expectation here of how buildings should work, and the very materials, you know, the very basic elements, there's just kind of, you've just sorted it out much better than other countries in Europe.
Dave doesn't think that at all. He's actually got British builders who are building in Switzerland, right? You're reversing the trend, right?
Yeah. No.
No, thank you.
not when we talk about windows. I think that we have a law, like an energy law.
We do in England as well.
Yeah, but since a long time. We have it. Yeah. We have it since like the oil crisis in the 70s. We have a really restricted law. So actually the window builder, I think the windows are often too sturdy and too bulky for what they can. So I think when I went to Japan, they're allowed to build stuff I would dream of, because they're thin profiles, and I don't know if they have any law. So they have it's an advantage in the quality, but also a disadvantage in what you actually can do with it.
Do you think that there's almost an aesthetic sort of narrative, because I think that maybe to the untrained eye, if you look at a lot of, you know, what comes out of Switzerland, you know, there is a boxiness to it, and the solid almost becomes a defining part of the aesthetic. And I think it's, as Hugo's saying, because so much of it also exists, you know, within these borders, and because you must be taking in new talent, you know, all the time, you know, in terms of, you know, practicums, in terms of interns, etc. Do you already sort of know what you're going to get, and do you sometimes also as an employer, you know, in design architecture, you know, maybe wish that there was a little bit more diversity?
I mean, it's anyway a difficult question how you source people, and we have the ETH in Zurich, so we have a good source of really high talented and good trained people, and actually we use this source and we go there and we have a look and we see this quality that comes, and I think the diversity is actually not required. I think our clients are happy with what we deliver so far, and if we have to get more like innovative or crazy projects, then we're probably very old.
And that sounds like it means that the innovative and crazy projects are maybe ones that are coming from overseas, potentially.
Yeah, hopefully.
David Marquardt, thank you very much for that.
You're welcome.
You could sort of stand in any time for, I think, you know, Andrew or on Hugo's program. I didn't tell you both. It actually was an audition today, in fact. I think you did a really good job.
I think you do your job as well, actually.
Oh, do you think so? Yeah. Okay, well, maybe. Anyway, that's all for this second edition of the program of Midori House out of Zurich. Are you going to come back again, Andrew?
I think we should go on the road more often.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying it. Hugo? Where next?
Yes, please.
Yeah, I think it's worked very well. And it's all thanks to Katie Bilboa, don't you think?
She's done a fine job.
Absolutely. That was our producer today. Also, Fernando Augusto Pacheco was our researcher, along with Tom Hall. And our studio manager today was Tom Wenger here at Tone Studio Z in Zurich. In 3 hours' time, the Monocle Daily is back at 2200 London time with Emma Nelson and Ted Kravitz in the driver's seat. Midori House is back where it belongs in London tomorrow. We're all going to be here. We're going to be sticking around because we're doing a little bit of a party tomorrow evening with our friends at Kuoni. Headlines are next right here on Monocle 24 from all of us here in Zurich. It is Tschüss, auf Wiedersehen, goodbye.